Hey everybody, this is Mike Van Meter, and welcome to the Mike Van Meter Show. And this is your one-stop shop for everything having to do with the Constitution, freedom, liberty, and frankly, I think just the best way of living your life. And I am very excited tonight to have with us a guest, Curtis Fox, who has written a book called Hybrid Warfare. And this is about the Russian approach to strategic competition and conventional military conflict. And boy, is this, you know, we'll talk about an appropriate time to be talking about this with all of the things that are going on in the world right now, not just in Russia, but other parts of the world. And we may talk about some of those too. But as many of you know, there's an election coming up here in November, and I am running in the Northern Virginia area, the 11th Congressional District, and running for U.S. Congress. And so these are going to be issues that I will face in Congress, and these are things that we need to deal with, because I got to tell you folks, as far as I'm concerned, the world is about ready to get set on fire. And it's a very dangerous place right now, and we have an absolute lack of leadership, in my opinion, and we need to do something about it. And it's important for all of us, me especially, but for all of us to be educated on what's going on around the world, the conflicts that we face, and then more importantly, how are we going to deal with them as we move forward. And I'm very excited to have Curtis on the show so he can talk to us about what's going on. And he and I had a discussion earlier tonight about the book, and I find it's fascinating, and I know you will too. And so with that, I want to welcome Curtis to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
Hey, it's my pleasure. And just tell us, before we talk about the book, just kind of give everybody a little bit about your background and maybe even, you know, what made you decide to write this book in the first place?
Sure. Well, you know, I need to start off by saying, of course, all opinions are my own and do not affect, you know, any official policy expressed by the government. My background is I come first from mechanical engineering. I actually started at Virginia Tech, and I worked on a few projects in renewable energy. One of my favorites was actually a small wind turbine. After that, I actually enlisted in the Army, I won my Green Beret and learned to speak Russian, during my time in service. After two deployments abroad, I was offered a graduate school recommendation to Georgetown from a colleague I had met on deployment, and it was that was a difficult offer to turn down at the time, and so I got out a little bit earlier than I expected, and I attended McDonough School of Business at Georgetown. After that, what, a small brief stint in financial services, and now I work as an R&D project manager.
Well, fantastic. So you speak Russian, but what made you want to write this book on the hybrid warfare? Because, you know, writing a book is just a huge undertaking, and I'm sure there just must have been something that, you know, sparked your interest or motivated you to do this. And I would imagine that there was a lot of concerns on your part as far as people understanding the Russians and how they operate.
Well, you know, first off, you know, speak Russian is a strong word to use now. Unfortunately, if you don't use the language, it kind of declines. And if you approach a Russian in the United States and just start speaking to them in their language, they kind of shy away from you. They're a little shocked by it, and they don't know what to think of you. So, unfortunately, I haven't been able to get as much practice. I can probably still read a newspaper, but my, you know, my dialogue has gotten very weak. The real inspiration for the book came when I was actually sitting in a team room, and I had a little downtime and I was waiting for my next assignment, and somebody threw me a binder, and it was entitled The Russian Way of War. And I dove into it, and I forget who published it, but maybe it was a RAND Corporation thing. But it went into great detail about the Russian annexation of Crimea. By great detail, I mean they were talking about like which units and which, you know, let's say Spetsnaz brigades were used to secure what objectives. And it was fascinating to me to understand how, an adversary military like the Russians, a near peer competitor, uses, different tools for different problems. understanding how it is that they conceptualized that mission, which, you know, was a very, very successful modern intervention, that was the impetus that had me start collecting more and more materials on the subject matter. And it started out as just interest reading, which slowly developed into a thesis, which I started building more meat on, and that started to look like a chapter. And sooner or later, that chapter was starting to have attached additional chapters. And before I knew it, I was writing a book. It took me about 4 years.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And what a huge project. So tell us a bit more about, I mean, obviously, we have the situation going on over in the Ukraine. And I don't know how you want to approach that. As far as you want to start there, or do you want to work up to how Russia got involved, why they got involved in the Ukraine? Because I got to tell you, as I go around and I talk to most Americans, I don't think Americans understand what is going on over there, why it's going on. Do you agree with that?
I think that's absolutely the case. I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of people that actually don't know where Ukraine is on the map.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, they hear about atrocities. I think those things, you know, raise their blood pressure a little bit. But they don't know what's going on, and they don't really know why it's an American problem, or, you know, maybe a NATO problem. The principal thing at play here is a Russian grand strategy that certainly transcends Vladimir Putin. Putin is the most powerful or the most important power broker in Russia, but he's not Joseph Stalin, and there's no comparison between the two individuals. But he is looking at an executive dashboard from Russia that would be very, very familiar to Peter the Great or Catherine the Great or Vladimir Lenin. And he's pursuing largely the same grand strategy. The Rus ethnicity, when it emerged, back in the 8th century, has only ever really been able to achieve security by expanding. The Russians live on the vast northern Eurasian steppe. And, when they grow enough to run into another ethnicity, they can either conquer them and subserviate them into their numbers or drive them out of those lands. And that's the way that they grew until they, you know, finally became a recognized nation state coming out of the high Middle Ages. Peter the Great and Catherine the Great worked very hard to move the boundaries of the Russian Empire forward into Eastern Europe, and they subsumed a lot of the territories that we would recognize as, you know, the Eastern Bloc today, and that would include the Ukraine. And so there is a connection in their history to Ukraine, and there's a credible argument to be made that the Ukrainian ethnicity and the Russian ethnicity, for a lot of their history, were deeply intertwined, and for most of it, they were considered one people. But they split the Soviet Union rose under Vladimir Lenin, and Ukraine was made a separate Soviet Socialist Republic. It's not 100% clear why Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin decided to do that, rather than including Ukraine and Russia itself. It might be that they wanted to show that other nations were participating in the communist experiment, not just Russia itself. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine emerged as an independent state from that Soviet collapse, and the Russians actually signed a treaty with Ukraine to get back all of its Soviet era nuclear ordnance from Ukraine in exchange for a recognition of Ukrainian sovereignty. The grand strategy that I mentioned with Peter the Great really hit its apogee in 1945 after Joseph Stalin successfully conquered most of Eastern Europe. He had heavy ground forces stationed in Eastern Germany. I think recall the numbers. I think the Soviet Union was fielding something around 300 divisions by the end of World War II. And just for a barometer of where that is, the United States was only fielding 90 divisions between both the European and Pacific theaters. So, you know, they had a massive overmatch in terms of, military firepower at the end of World War II. And they stationed that all in East Germany, and they secured all the states behind them as, let's say, socialist puppet governments, and that was their defense in depth. It allowed them to anchor all of their political boundaries on hard geographic barriers, like the Baltic Sea, the Black Sea, the Carpathian Mountains, and in the south would be the Caucasus Mountains and the Gobi Desert. And doing that, or anchoring your boundary on those geographic barriers, it gives them a great deal more security. And it allows them to just kind of use their existing military capabilities to plug the gaps. And so that's, and unfortunately, in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, so did all of their defense in depth. And when that happened, the Russians saw a profound decline in their, their strategic environment, and it's something they've been scrambling to redress ever since. Now, it's not that Putin necessarily wants to restore the Soviet Empire, but he understands that Russia, he understands what Russia's security interests are, and he'll move the ball forward whenever he can. And that's what he's doing in Ukraine.
Wow. You talked about this. You raised the question, is this a NATO problem? Is this an American problem? Because I think that many people in the United States are really struggling with that. And I question this too. And I'm not exactly sure where I lie on that fence right now. Maybe address that a little bit. Is this an American or NATO problem? And if so, why?
Well, the short answer is yes. I do think that we have a strategic interest in making sure that the regime in Kiev does not fall. It's not a simple problem, and it's one that I think needs to be more effectively articulated to the American public. The shortest piece of this to take a bite on is that the Russians, when they conduct hybrid wars in pursuit of the strategic objectives that I just described, what they're doing is using a series of very well coordinated preparatory activities that allow their elite ground forces or their special operations units, the Spetsnaz, the much vaunted Spetsnaz and the VDV, their airborne forces, to seize a number of limited objectives. And then once they have elite forces on the ground, they immediately surge in heavy ground forces to entrench those gains and make it a fait accompli. And that's what they did, let's say, in the Russo-Georgian War. That's what they did in the Crimean annexation. And that's what they attempted to do in the war in Donbass, in 2014 and on into 2015. That becomes a real problem because the Russians conduct these interventions on what they try to establish is plausible deniability. There's three operative terms they use. And it would be maskirovka, which is basically camouflage, aktivnost, which is activity, and vnyezhodnost, which is surprise. And under those three terms, maskirovka means they prefer to work through a hidden hand. You see this maybe when they use, institutions like Wagner abroad, and they can plausibly say that, well, those aren't Russian troops and they're not doing anything. Or, when little green men showed up in Crimea, Vladimir Putin disavowed them. I don't know who they are. And then aktivnost are all the little things they do to intimidate the host nation government, or let's say the target nation government, into inaction. That would be bribing local politicians and threatening the police chief so that he doesn't put down a Russian sponsored riot. That would be targeting, let's say a local news station, forcing them to put on Russian propaganda. And then, the vnyezhodnost, the surprise, is the rapid surging in of forces. It's the rapid employment of soft against, limited targets, and then the entrenchment of the heavy ground forces. in a situation where Ukraine were to collapse and Russia was on the border, in, let's say, the southern military district of Russia, was on the border with vehemently anti-Russian countries like Poland or Romania, then they would, then they might be enticed to try such strategy. And in a situation where the Russians, let's say they perceive the West as weak, or they perceive that the West won't respond, and we lose a, let's say we lose deterrence, they could very well attempt this kind of a strategy in a place like Warsaw. And after, you know, let's say after systematic extermination under the Nazis and then 50 years of slavery under communism, the Poles will not be dominated by anybody anymore. And they will not, especially not from Germany or Russia. And in a situation where the Russians are attempting to meddle in Polish politics, and even, you know, and even putting, you know, military forces into Polish territory, or letting loose artillery shells, over the Polish border, the Poles will respond in a very muscular way. And that is the pathway to a war with the regime in Moscow. And it is a key point of escalation, that could lead to a general nuclear exchange. And that is the situation that we should absolutely try to avoid. And for that reason, it is in the United States' best interest, and it's in NATO's best interest, to ensure that Ukraine remains an independent nation, preferably a buffer state between the two of us.
So, pretty interesting, but it's not, they are not part of NATO, correct?
No, they're not.
So that complicates things a bit.
Part of NATO.
That complicates things a bit. Can maybe delve into that a little bit. How does that, because it seems to me, and I'll just kind of give you sort of what I'm seeing and what I'm thinking, and you correct me if I'm wrong on this. Okay, so we have, because I think this is what a lot of, I think this is what a lot of Americans are confused about and really have issues with. You have a country that is not part of NATO, and they are in this conflict with Russia, and that is horrible. That is absolutely horrible. But there are many Americans that say, but is that a problem? Now, you put together a strong argument, but on the other hand, they are still not a member of NATO. And we are putting a lot of assets into the country. So, in effect, you could make the argument that we are at war with Russia, because much of the equipment, ammunition, and probably support in many, many different ways is going over there. And it feels like to many Americans that we are being pulled into this conflict, and we sure as heck are spending a hell of a lot of money on this. And people are scratching their heads and saying, what is the American interest in this? And where are the rest of the NATO countries? Are they contributing the way that we are? Now, I know that's kind of a loaded question, but try to help us understand this.
Sure. So the first part of your question, are they a NATO member and why should we help a non-NATO member? So first off, you know, some of our most important allies are non-NATO members. You know, there's Colombia in Latin America, and there's Japan and Korea in the Pacific Rim. You know, Taiwan is a non-NATO country. We're increasingly developing, you know, a strong defense relationship with India as part of the Quad Agreement, and Australia is not a NATO member. So whether or not they're a NATO member doesn't really affect whether or not we might push, let's say, military assistance to them. The legal framework that we have for giving them all this military hardware is the World War II Lend-Lease Act. And the Lend-Lease Act is still active. And that's the legal framework under which all of this equipment goes abroad. I'm trying to remember the rest of the question.
I guess the rest of the question is, okay, But why is this our problem? And we are spending a lot of money. And in addition to that, are other nations contributing the way that we are? Because we have a country, yes. And this is why I'm asking this. This is horrible, and people understand that this is a problem over there. But Americans are having a hard time digesting why this is a specifically an American problem. You have all of this money going over to Ukraine. There's a lot of corruption going on in that part of the world, so people are concerned about that. But meanwhile, we have lots of issues here in the United States that we're not addressing. And I think in my case, running for public office, these are the questions that the voters have, is why is that our problem? And why is that the resources we're sending there not better suited in this nation?
Yeah, let me answer the last part of your question first, and I'll run back to what the NATO contributions are. I think your concerns are well-founded, and I think that healthy skepticism in a democracy is a good thing. I would say I've already made the case for why it's our problem. If the Russians feel that they can conduct one of these interventions, one of these military interventions below the threshold of an overt declared war with a NATO country, that's the real pathway to war between the United States and Russia. Any NATO member can invoke the Article 5 obligations under the NATO treaty structure and draw the United States into a war. And that's something that we very much want to avoid. As to what the Europeans are contributing, actually, they're contributing a lot. You do have to remember that their defense stocks are not nearly as deep as ours. So while our contributions are primarily in, old retired military hardware, it's stuff that we're clearing out of our warehouses, and actually we haven't really, of the combat systems we would take into the next war, we actually haven't dug into those stocks at all. It's all the stuff that we've retired. So what we're doing is cleaning out our warehouses. And there is a small degree of financial support apart from that, that funds, let's say day-to-day operations of the Ukrainian government. The Europeans are the inverse. They are sending some headline, military systems. The big ones that come to mind are the German Leopard 2 tank, or the British Challenger, or the French Leclerc. The Poles and the Romanians and a few other NATO allies still have former Soviet hardware, that the Ukrainians have actually like the maintenance tools and kit to restore. So that would be like the T-73 main battle tanks. And so a lot of that stuff is going to Ukraine from the Europeans, but because the European stocks are a lot shallower than the United States, their principal contributions are financial. And so there's kind of an inverse there where they're spending a lot more money than we are, and we're shipping over, a lot more hardware than they are. And that's kind of the relationship it has to go. I would say one bright point of this is that the Europeans seem to realize that they have to take their own defense a lot more seriously.
Yeah.
Most of our European partners were not meeting their NATO obligations. And it's kind of shook them out of their apathy. The fact that the Russians could conduct an intervention like this kind of woke them up. So while they clear out their existing stocks of military equipment, they are placing very large orders, for the next thing. So that would be the new tank and the new aircraft. I believe the Germans are going to be ordering, some F-35 fifth generation fighters. So the fact that the Europeans they understand that they have to toe their weight in their own national defense is a positive development out of this.
Oh, no doubt about that. And I think our previous president really made that clear, that they need to carry their weight, no doubt about it. What's interesting to me is that I remember when this campaign kicked off, about 2 years ago now? In fact, I think we just passed the anniversary of the kickoff. And you're watching this major world power go against Ukraine. And the impression I had, and it's probably ignorance on my part, it was, well, this isn't going to last very long. I mean, you have Russia, right? And you know, in my day in the U.S. Navy, we were, the big threat was Russia. That's what we trained against. You know, the aircraft that I flew, that was our opponent. And, you know, you get this impression that you have this very large country and they're just going to bulldoze this Ukraine because, after all, they're a major world power and, you know, they're a threat to everyone. And here we are 2 years later and they're still slogging away with it with Ukraine. And it's kind of amazing to me that I don't want Russia to win. Don't get me wrong with that. I'm just kind of surprised that you have this major power and there's 2 years later, they're slogging away. And what do you think is going on there? And how long is this going to go on? And is there an end game with this? Or is this just going to be another one of these forever wars? And it seems like every conflict that goes on in the last 23 years just goes on and on. And what is the objective? For example, you juxtapose that with World War II. We knew what the threat was. Everybody knew what the threat was. The goal was to eliminate the threat, and all resources were put into eliminating that threat, and we were done and we moved on. Why is it that why do these things go on for years and years, in your opinion?
Man, that's a hard question to answer. And to get into it, I really need to get into the mechanics of the Russian institution.
Yeah.
What I can tell you about why the reason so many of these modern conflicts never end is, in my opinion, a lot of that is because of the advent of, let's say, mass media. I think this is something that people don't really want to know, but it's absolutely true, is that history is a very brutal, unforgiving place. And history is full of horrible, horrible atrocities. Losing a war used to mean that the entire population in a given area was going to die, and a lot of them were going to be taken captive and put into permanent servitude. Genocide was not a thing, and that was the case for most of human history. And we have abandoned, let's say, that concept of total war in the post-World War II era, and we might even call that, you know, a degree of human moral progress. But one of the, I think a good portion of the reason for that is that, you know, when you do these things in a part of the world that most people wouldn't normally notice, it ends up on the television and they see what you're doing. And so it creates a strong incentive to restrain yourself, using the excesses of military force. And that was the case with, let's say, the United States and Vietnam, right? Like the United States was absolutely capable of running roughshod and conquering Vietnam in a real way. But that's not what we wanted to do. We wanted to establish a stable regime under local governance. That's a different thing, and that's a different goal. And quite frankly, it's much harder to do. I think that's, part of the reason a lot of these conflicts draw out, is that, total war is no longer efficable. To go into how this war, we all expected the Russians to do a lot better. I really need to dive into the mechanics of the Russian institution. And that takes a little bit of space, so maybe I'll pause here and give you an opportunity for comment.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point. And it really bothers me, particularly as somebody going into public office, when I see us putting American treasure, lives, money, but particularly lives, into areas where it doesn't seem like we've made a total commitment for a victory. That bothers me a great deal. And I'm saying that as a guy that was, I was on the line, as you were on the line. And I never liked the idea that we could be sacrificed in an area where there was not a clear objective to win. And I think that you make a strong point that social media has, and television has a lot to do with that now. That you can see this even in the conflict that's going on in Israel and the calls for Israel to restrain itself and how it responds to the brutal attack that they suffered. And I think that's a real danger because in many respects, if you are not quick, decisive, and effective in obtaining your victory, that you actually put more lives at risk by doing that. And it just, as we prolong these things without victory, I mean, it seems like we go into these conflicts and we're there for a long time and we walk away and there was no victory. So the question, particularly as an elected official, is why were you there in the first place? Why in the world would you put people in harm's way when you did not support them to have victory and you put their lives on the line, but you didn't equip them and support them in ways where there was a very clear objective? I think that you have a moral obligation as a leader to do that. If you're not willing to fight for a victory, then don't put people on the ground. That's just the way that I look at it. Am I looking at it wrong?
No, I don't think that you're looking at it wrong. The nuance I might add is that is von Clausewitz, and it's the famous military treatise on war that he wrote in the aftermath of Napoleon's conquest. And one of his most important points was that war is simply the continuation of politics by other means. And his point was that war has to achieve a precisely defined political objective. And unfortunately, and let's say the necessary but messy discourse of modern democracies, those objectives are not nearly as clearly defined as they should be. One of the reasons we were very successful in World War II was because Franklin Delano Roosevelt delegated most of our strategic planning to George C. Marshall and the Admiral Nimitz. And because of that, the military entered the war in both theaters with very well precisely defined objectives of what it is that they were supposed to achieve. And that was something that Marshall, as the Army Chief of Staff in particular, insisted on the Combined Chiefs of Staff. This was, the World War II era version of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but it was a combined command between American and British generals. And he was constantly, holding them accountable to those objectives. And unfortunately, there's an interesting book on this if you're interested, if you want to do some reading on it. It's called The Generals. It was written by Tom Ricks. And he kind of breaks down, the failures of let's say American civil military discourse. Douglas MacArthur was a principal villain in that story, but a lot of that breakdown is what created the morass of Vietnam and it continues to rebound to this day. Those are problems and if I were to advise our political leaders, it's something that I would tell them sorely, sorely needs fixing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a big part of it. I think the key there was when you go back and you studied the Second World War, the conduct of the war was run by the generals and the admirals. It was the military people making military decisions. And it seems like you could argue Korea, interference, certainly Vietnam. Up until present day, it seems like these conflicts are more run by the politicians than they are by the professionals on the ground. Is that a correct assessment?
Well, it wasn't. That wasn't Tom Ricks' assessment. He said there's another book to read. It's called Dereliction of Duty by H.R. McMaster. And he talks in a great more detail about how Lyndon B. Johnson manipulated the Joint Chiefs of Staff in order to falsely solicit their support publicly for the Vietnam War. and he goes into this quite a bit, and he talks about how Lyndon B. Johnson uses I'm struggling for his name. He was chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and then he was appointed to U.S. ambassador to Saigon.
McNamara.
McNamara is Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
But yes, McNamara and Robert McNamara, and that'll come to me. Anyway, he uses two individuals in particular to micromanage the war, the Secretary of Defense and the ambassador to Saigon. General Westmoreland was reduced mostly to an errand boy. He didn't really have any strong decision making in Vietnam. He certainly was not the architect of grand strategy. But what Ricks points out is that Westmoreland proves over and over and over again that he's not really capable of being an architect to grand strategy. It's not within his repertoire. It's not in his skill set. Creighton Abrams does a much better job when Westmoreland is finally relieved after the Tet Offensive. Creighton Abrams does a much better job of understanding the conflict than Westmoreland does. And one of the things he puts his finger on is something that the Marines were already putting into practice in, the parts of South Vietnam that they had responsibility for. The Marines realized that their principal objective needed to be to protect the population itself from the Viet Cong. And that Westmoreland kept trying to pursue a chess-like victory, like a World War II combat engagement. He kept hoping he could catch a company of the Viet Cong out in the open and hit them with heavy artillery and roll them over with superior firepower. And they just wouldn't stand and fight at that level. What they would do is retreat, and then they would come back and they'll kill all the local villagers who collaborated with you. And so, the Marines adopted, a better strategy, and Westmoreland put his finger on that, and he really, really, for a few years, turned things around in Vietnam. And unfortunately, the culture war in the United States was catching up to it by then. And so, by 1971, the American mission in Vietnam was on the decline. But my point is simply that it's unfair to say that if it were not for the political, class interfering constantly with military leadership, that the war would have gone a lot better. I think in a lot of cases, we don't teach strategic thinking in the military education process nearly as much as we should. And we put individuals in charge of things that probably shouldn't be in charge of them, just because they have the right rank and it's their turn. And unfortunately, General Westmoreland was not as good of a general as Creighton Abrams. And, he was a pale shadow compared to a strategic thinker like George C. Marshall, or Dwight D. Eisenhower. And, they should have put somebody better in charge of the war. And if they had, it might very well have been the case that he would have not gotten the micromanagement from political leadership that he did.
Yeah. Fair point there. Very good. And but then we jumped to where we are today, and you wanted to share a little bit about the Russians and how their thinking plays into what they're doing right now.
Yes. So do you remember back in 2018, the assassination of Sergei Skripal? So the two Russian GRU agents, this is the Military Intelligence Service, They found a turncoat. He'd been flipped by MI6, and he was now living in exile in Salisbury in the UK. And they found him, and they went to his house, and they spread Novichok nerve agent on his door, in an attempt to assassinate him. And then they were on a flight to Moscow within 5 hours, or St. Petersburg, or wherever. What happened, it was a very, let's call it, ham-fisted attempt at an assassination. And it revealed a very, let's say, impressive investigative and counterintelligence capability with MI5. MI5 had these guys leaving their assigned posts in Ukraine. One of them had actually, they were both GRU specimens men, but one of them had actually been awarded the Hero of the Russian Federation Board, which was kind of like their Congressional Medal of Honor. And these guys, both MI5 tracked them, actually going up to the FSB National Counterterrorism Center for 2 weeks of training, and then boarding a plane, I think from Moscow to London Heathrow. They got off the plane, they took a metro to Salisbury. They did a reconnaissance of the guy's house, came back to London, stayed in the hotel for the night, and then went back to Salisbury the next day, sprayed this stuff on his door. They dropped the bottle in a trash can, and they were on a flight back to Moscow within 5 hours. And MI5 had all of that. And the evidence was so stark that, in using nerve agent on another country's sovereign soil is such an egregious red line violation of international norms that in a massive showing of solidarity with the United Kingdom, the countries of Europe collectively expelled over 150 Russian diplomats, many of whom were probably covert intelligence officers. Then another 50 from the United States, all of them persona non grata. And when that happened, the collective loss of intelligence for the Russians, nevertheless diplomatic standing, was incalculable. The head of the GRU, his name was Igor Korobov, Colonel General Igor Korobov, was summoned to the Kremlin later that summer for, quote, an intense dressing down by Vladimir Putin. And he collapsed in his home about a month later. And we'll never know if that collapse was, from a bullet behind the ear, or maybe he accidentally tied himself to a chair and then accidentally fell in a lake. Or maybe he dropped a toaster in the bathtub.
Accidentally fell off the 16th floor of a building. It happens over there.
Yeah. But, he died. He died in a very tragic manner. After that point, the GRU, as far as my research can tell, was not allowed to participate in the planning process and bring information to the Kremlin anymore. This was a massive mistake. The GRU is Russia's most effective intelligence agency. They run maybe six times more agents abroad than the SVR does. The SVR is the Foreign Intelligence Service for the Russians. But the GRU is also the only one that wasn't split up and reorganized after the fall of the Soviet Union. It's been completely unreformed. It actually is the oldest intelligence service too. It was actually stood up by Leon Trotsky. It's that old, and they have operational control of all of Russia's different Spetsnaz brigades. The Spetsnaz brigades are the strategic reconnaissance assets for each of the military districts. In practice. They're operationally controlled by the GRU, and the GRU uses these reconnaissance assets to do all of the preparation of the environment and the advanced force operations leading into any military intervention, the Crimean annexation, the war in Georgia, and Donbass being, three really good examples. The intervention in Syria being an excellent example of how Spetsnaz are doctrinally supposed to be employed. And removing the GRU from the planning process because they were just not trusted to participate anymore was a catastrophic mistake. And maybe another thing to say about the GRU too is this is an intelligence agency that recruits most of its operatives, its spies, from the Russian special operations community. And so a lot of these guys coming in, they're door kickers, and these are the kind of guys that have competitions in weightlifting and stuff like that. And then they become spies, and they don't really have the appreciation of the sensitivities of international relations. And so that's why they do things like the Skripal assassination. They see a target, they calculate which tool would be best for that target, and then how much leverage and force I have to apply to it in order to to achieve the desired end state. And that there's not a lot of higher order thinking that goes into it. And that's a real problem for the GRU, but, you know, nevertheless, it's probably their best intelligence tool. Well, when you remove them from the planning process, the GRU answers directly to the Russian general staff. And that's the agency that's supposed to build them their intelligence packet for planning an intervention like the Ukraine invasion. And without them in place to do all of that heavy lifting, the intervention was a catastrophe. The principal intelligence engagement for that was all done by the FSB, which is, the FSB is the primary Russian inheritor of the KGB. And it's a combination of, let's say it's a national police service, kind of like the FBI. But it's also a secret police, and a domestic security service. And their fifth directorate is responsible for running agents in a counterintelligence capacity abroad. They just don't have the requisite expertise to gather all of the information that the general staff would need to plan out a war like this. What the Kremlin and what the general staff were told by the FSB was that the Ukrainians were very pro-Russian, that the regime in Kiev was despised, that Vladimir Zelensky was a hated and unpopular leader, and that Ukraine would collapse in about 10 days. They assumed that most of the Ukrainian armed forces would defect to Russia. And then another couple of peculiar things happened. One of the big ones was that, the Russians used military exercises that they schedule annually in the late fall to start surging troops to the border of Ukraine. And this started out as, 40,000 troops and then 50,000, 80,000, 120,000, leading up into into January and February of 2022, that number got up to almost 200,000 troops. That's, at the time, that was about the full expeditionary potential of the Russian ground forces. But those soldiers were not being given invasion plans. Apparently, they were being told to plan for field exercises. And, the division command staffs and the brigade command staffs and the army command staffs were being told to plan for exercises to demonstrate Russia's seriousness, both to the Ukrainians and to NATO. Regarding demands that Russia was making politically. They apparently, this according to the testimony of a large number of Russian paratroopers who were captured after the war started, a lot of them were told that once they were on the plane and they were about to parachute into Ukraine, that they were actually going to war. And they had thought they were doing a training jump until then. And then they were told on the aircraft that you're actually going to war. And I think some of that secrecy was an attempt at information security, but a great deal of it was, it was just ham-fisted management by Moscow, micromanagement by Moscow as well. They didn't actually appoint an overall theater commander for this until maybe four months after the conflict had started. Before that, they tried to run it from a command center in Moscow.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, they broke so many doctrinal rules in doing this that it's hard to know where to start and which thing was most catastrophic. But not telling your soldiers what they're going to be doing had to be the biggest one.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this: where do you think we're going with this? And when I say we, I mean. This conflict, is this going to be another one of those never-ending wars, or do you see an end to it? What is the objective? I really think your average American could not articulate to you what anybody's objective in this is.
No, I believe that's the case. The objective for Russia, I think, they would love to be able to depose the regime in Kiev, but I think at this point they need to save face. If they could conquer you know, let's say Ukrainian territory up to the Dnieper River, that might be sufficient narrative for Vladimir Putin to tell, you know, his countrymen that the war was worth the sacrifice. But time is on his side. What the Russians are doing now, they've sacrificed, they've taken horrible, horrible casualties. They've taken over 300,000 casualties, and I think they're over 70,000 dead at this point. And most of their premier combat units in the VDV and Spetsnaz brigades have been utterly shattered. I mean, they've been hollowed out of their pre-war potential. And the Russians have revealed that they can't conduct even combined arms maneuver. They had that convoy, you know, that tried to drive south from Belarus to Kiev, and they didn't plan enough fuel for that trip, so you know, it ran out of fuel, you know, 3 days after 3 days, and then after another 5 days, the soldiers in those tanks ran out of food, and so they all had to get out of those tanks and walk back north to Belarus. And that, you know, that was how bad the strategic planning on this was. And I don't blame the soldiers or even a lot of the officers. They weren't given the information from Moscow to plan for these things in the way they should have. But because Russia has lost all of its premier combat equipment and they've lost their best trained and most experienced personnel, including over 200 colonels, 200 colonels. I mean, they've lost 8 generals, but 200 colonels is irreplaceable. I mean, those are your regimental and brigade commanders. And losing 200 colonels is catastrophic because no one knows how to run those units in the field. And you have to train somebody new to replace those guys. And they were lost, not just colonels themselves, but their command staffs as well. That's not just maneuver, but logistics and supply that have to be figured out now. So the Russians are going back to a formula that they know very well and that they can execute very well. And it's a formula that, you know, it looks a lot more like the Chechen Wars, the first and second Chechen Wars. And it's a World War I style slow creep forward. They realize that they can muster more firepower than the Ukrainians and they can win in those general exchanges. And so what they've done is entrenched their positions. Their fortifications are so big now that the naked eye can see them from space. And, the Ukrainians, when they try to launch some kind of an offensive, they have a very, very hard time penetrating even the outer rings of those fortifications. And the Russians just advance them inch by inch with mass, you know, supported by mass artillery barrages. And it's very difficult for the Ukrainians to counter that. They can, if the Russians are willing to, you know, take, you know, 3-to-1 casualties in those exchanges, you know, that's sufficient to move the ball forward. And that's a sacrifice they're willing to make. And while they advance the front, they are taking long-range cruise missiles. You know, whether those are air launched from, you know, strategic bombers or whether those are, you know, ground launched or maybe even naval launched, you know, they throw these things, or maybe the Iskander ICBMs, they're not really ICBMs. They're just, let's say they're regional ballistic missiles. They throw these things at Ukrainian infrastructure, and they target directly, you know, the Ukrainian economy and the Ukrainian populace itself. And their math is pretty ruthless. They're betting that if they can create enough refugees and destroy enough infrastructure, that the Ukrainian economy will not be able to support an army in the field. And they're probably right. There's, you know, the troops in Ukraine's trenches are not going to be able to fight if they haven't had any food. And that strategy may take, you know, 3 to 5 years to play out, but it's an exchange that Russia can win. And it doesn't require a great deal of technical sophistication in their military in order to achieve it.
Well, the big fear that Americans have is, do you see us being drawn into this conflict any more than we already are?
No, I don't. Unless, you know, unless somebody does something very stupid, like put, you know, U.S. forces or NATO forces in Ukraine. You know, and I just don't, I don't think that anyone believes that's on the table. I think, you know, a couple of individuals like, was the French leader Macron have thrown the idea out, but I don't think it's really under serious consideration. I think a lot of those statements by European partners are meant to keep, are meant to keep Russia off balance.
Wow. Well, how long do you, is it even possible to predict how long this is going to go?
I don't think it's possible to predict how long it's going to go. I would tell you the telltale signs that it's moving to a conclusion. You know, NATO, Ukraine is going to become increasingly dependent on Western support. And if that Western support dries up, the likelihood that they will collapse, is going to increase exponentially. We should look at the suffering of the Russian economy. How effective is Russia at substituting Western supply chains in order to meet in order for its economy to continue running? Let's say. And the extent to which they are not able to bring oil to the market, it will have a big impact on their capacity to continue the war. Historically, about 40% of the Russian national government's revenues have come from oil and gas exports from Gazprom and that's a very large proportion of their national income. I do believe there's always going to be actors like China and India that are very much interested in buying Russian oil below market rates, and that's something that we need to figure out how to crack down on. But Russia is also increasingly trading with the BRICS, and they're doing it in non-dollar denominated currencies, and that's a real problem too.
Mm-hmm. Well, my next question will be largely political, and you let me know if you feel that you can answer this or not. We have an election this year. How do you think things will change if we have a change in administrations?
Well, I don't know how much they'll change. I think it will radically depend on what the new president might do in terms of his staffing in the office of the Secretary of Defense and who's advising him on these things. President Trump has a tendency to say things on the campaign trail, but when it comes to implementation, I think he's very pragmatic. I think he is very open to the advice of people who say they have subject matter expertise. There's strengths and weaknesses to that. It would be my impression that a Trump administration, would be a wild card. I don't know what the impact would be. I do know that he's made promises that he could end the war, first day when he's in office. I don't know if that's possible or not, but I'm open-minded enough to say, okay, let's see it.
Well, it is interesting. It would be interesting to see the approach that he took. It does seem to me that there's, as far as we're concerned, there's this stalemate that's going on, and maybe a fresh new idea on this would be worthwhile to take a look at. And, does that mean that we pull everything out? Does it mean that we provide enough assistance that the Ukrainians can win? Who knows what that will be? But it just does seem to me that we're just involved in one more quagmire. I won't delve into Israel, but it seems like there's a lot of things that we could talk about there as well. But man, there's so much to talk about with your book. I mean, I find it fascinating because you're telling me a lot of things that I've not heard, or I've heard in a general sense, but not quite in the details that you're talking about. And this seems like a very interesting book for people to read. And so tell us a bit about your book, how people can get it, how they can reach you. And I'd love to have you back on the program again to go even further, because each one of these topics, we could go on for about an hour. Like you said, there's a, you know, this takes up a lot of space, because this is an area which a lot of people don't understand. I know before we came on the air, you and I were talking about the Tucker Carlson interview that he did with Vladimir Putin. And it's a very confusing interview to people, because you have Putin going in and talking about history, and he spent quite a bit of time talking about Russian history. And most Americans sit back and go, what is this guy doing? And I'd love to have you back to talk about that and kind of break that down a little bit, because that part of the world is an area that most Americans are not paying attention to. But it's just one area that is very hostile right now. Of course, we have the conflict going on over in Israel. And then, of course, China is on the move. And now we have, you know, Iran is on the move. It seems like a very, very dangerous time. And we might want to talk about how all of this may or may not be interconnected. So I'd love to have you back on the program and tell us a bit more about how we can get hold of your book and reach out to you.
Yeah, it'd be fun. So you can find my book on Amazon right now. It is going to be released in bookstores in the near future. It's available both in hardcover and paperback. And in the next few weeks, we're hoping to have an audiobook version out as well. And of course, you can get an ebook version off of Amazon if you like. The first stores it's going to be released at are going to be the PX system on military posts. And we will branch out from there. And you can find me on the book's website. It's hybridwarfare.info. And, you know, if you want to get a hold of me, you can just click the email button up at the top right, and it will send a direct message to me and my publisher. Or you can just email me directly at curtis@hybridwarfare.info.
And that's fantastic. And thanks for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. Fascinating discussion. And we're going to have you on again soon. So thanks again, Curtis, for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thanks. And guys, as you know, we've got this election coming up in November. And if all of these issues are of concern to you, then you got to get out and vote. That's what you got to do, guys. You have to get out and vote and exercise your right as an American to select the next group of leaders we have in this country. And as you can hear from Curtis, we have a lot of issues that are going on, and we need leaders. We need people that are deep thinkers on this, and they're ready to take action. And so check that out. And also check out my podcast, The Mike Van Meter Show, and check us out on Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly Twitter, all these different areas. Guys, we will be talking with you soon. Take care. God bless America. Stay in the fight, guys. We'll talk with you soon.